Thank you so very much, Hugh. And our years of association have been delightful, and I hope they will continue, even though I am returning to the United States and my home this year. Oh, 5 months away. But I have always enjoyed my visits to New Zealand, a beautiful country, and I thank you that in spite of having been here so many times before, you have had the courage to invite me again on this very special occasion of the centenary of the Society in New Zealand. And it was because of the theme of the convention here this year that I thought I should think of, well, it set me to thinking, I'll put it that way, the theme towards another 100 years of theosophical endeavor. And I began to think about time. What is 100 years, you know? Well, for those who may have lived 100 years, and I doubt that there's anyone, I think there is no one in the audience who has yet passed that century mark in terms of this particular incarnation. But I know that one of your members, who passed away this past year, not so many months ago, had passed that century mark. And there are many people. I always remember the experience of a very good friend of mine with whom I was associated in the work of the American section for many years and who also with whom I shared a home at our Crotona Institute of Theosophy, Virginia Hansen, when she went to see a doctor in the community of Ojai, where Crotona is located in Southern California, and she mentioned to him that she was a vegetarian and she thought she'd better put everything straightforward so that the doctor would understand her situation and what she intended to do. And he said, how can I argue with that? You people at Crotona live forever. So, you see, we have a saying in the American section, at least, that old theosophists never die, they simply move to Ojai. That's why I'm returning there and expect to live there forever. But the theme, as I say, set my mind to thinking about time. Because when we speak about another 100 years, what are we talking about, as it were? We're all very fond of marking off time in convenient segments. You know, a day, a week, a month, a year, a decade. We're in the decade now leading up to the end of this millennium. Is it the end of the second millennium? Or is it the beginning of the third millennium? When so we talk about millennia, and I was just reading a report about the some of the latest scientific findings about our galaxy in the Theosophy Science newsletter. And we talk about light years, and we talk about AUs, which are astronomical units. I learned this just this afternoon, which mark the distance of the, in terms of light years, of the sun from the earth and the number of times you multiply that, which is staggering, isn't it? But every one of us carries, I suppose, a pocket calendar, a pocket diary at least, and we have to refer to it when we say, somebody says, can you meet me at such and such a time? Can you have lunch with me on such and such a date? We get out our little pocket diaries and we mark it down, yes, I'm free then and can have lunch with you. Our conception of time, of course, changes through the years. Certainly it changes as we grow older, and I can attest to that. Do you remember, for me it's a long time ago, how long a day seemed when you were told that tomorrow will be Christmas? And how long that would be, you know? How long was a day then? Our sense of time is so dependent on psychological states or conditions, you know, whether we're happy or sad, whether we're involved in an activity that is pleasurable or one that is painful, one that is arduous, boring. How long do you have to wait for a friend who is coming to see you? How long is that time? How long is the time that you sit in the doctor's office waiting for the test results to come back for some major test? How long is a minute, an hour? We've become accustomed, as I say, with astronomy now and the galaxies, we've become accustomed to measuring distance by time. When you're asked, how far is it from Sydney to Auckland? We do not give it in kilometers. I was going to say miles. We still are on miles in the United States. We give it in terms of the time it takes to fly from Sydney to Auckland, don't we? I suppose 100 years ago they might have given it in time it took for the ship to come from Sydney to Auckland. So time, what is it? What are we talking about? Underlying, I suggest, all of our various and varied perceptions of time, there is also a sense of something that is timeless. And it's that something that I'd like to explore with you if we can. A longing for a state in which no change will occur. In fact, it has been said that time is simply the dimension of the universe that allows change to happen. It rather keeps events apart, so to speak. Consequently, what we sense is not time or even the passing of time, but change and the occurrence of change. The lapse of time is simply the changes that occur. We're aware of it not as time, but as change. And so we sometimes say, but if only time would stand still, if only I could hold on to this moment forever, particularly the pleasurable moments. And of course, what we mean is simply, if only there would be no change. I'm reminded of a delightful story. One of my other failings, in addition to coining words, is telling stories, as some of you know. The delightful story about the Chinese lord who went hunting on one occasion. It belongs to the tradition known as elder tales, that is, stories that relate to the latter part of life. And quite obviously, I'm interested now in the stories that relate to the latter part of life. When we begin to think more about the passing of time and of change and its inevitability and even of endings. Well, as I say, the story is told of the noble lord, in fact, a great king, who went hunting on one occasion, accompanied by his closest companions. They paused at the top of a hill from which they could see for miles around. And as the king surveyed the scene, noting, of course, the rich fields, the prosperous villages that were all part of his realm, tears came to his eyes. He thought of his wealth, of his palace, his friends, the honor, the devotion that was being given to him by all of his people. And so he sighed and said, "To think that someday I will have to die and leave all this behind." And he continued to lament, and naturally his courtiers who surrounded him engaged also in the lament, thinking they too would lose their positions, their wealth, the favor that had been bestowed on them when they died. And so the king continued, Imagine if we could live forever." And the courtiers, of course being very obedient servants to a king, took up that phrase, imagine, their eyes shining with the imagination of it. Imagine if we could live forever. But one lord among them began to laugh. And the more the king lamented, and the more the lords and nobles kept saying, "Imagine if we could live forever," this one noble laughed heartily and continued laughing until finally the king said, "Well, what are you so happy about? Why are you laughing when the prospect of death is such a very sad one?" And finally, the laughing lord blurted out, "I just imagined what it would be like if we all lived forever, if there were no death. And thinking of that, I couldn't help but laugh." And he went on, "Well, then the first king would be alive, and the great sage, and all those who went before us, the great emperor, the heroic general, they would all still be living. And what would we be? And what would you be, your royal highness?" "A clerk, a simple clerk." Well, there was a hushed silence. The nobles wondering how the king would respond to such an irreverent statement. And finally, the king burst out laughing and saying, "Imagine, a clerk, a clerk." And he upbraided his nobles for encouraging him in his foolishness of imagining they could live forever. And he turned to the laughing lord and said, "Whenever I bewail my death again, simply cry out, 'A clerk, a clerk.'" Well, our lives do seem to be so bounded, as I say, by time, driven by time and constrained by time. Time, you know, has been called a familiar stranger. We all share some experience of time, some experience when we would say, "Imagine if we could live forever, if this moment could continue forever." Because there are times, are there not, moments of real reflection, moments perhaps of deep meditation, when we feel we have entered into a timeless state. Consider your own reaction to time. We're always living ahead of ourselves, aren't we? What we're going to do tomorrow, next year. This is why I said, I myself, 5 months I shall be returning to my home. And so all of the planning, we are always living in the future. Even as we store up the memories of what has been, our minds are busy, terribly busy and chattering with what must be done, what will be done, what could be done, how we will plan, what we will be doing. And yet, as I say, there are these moments, these reflective moments, when we seem to enter into a state of genuine timelessness. Perhaps such moments come in the contemplation of beauty. I'm sure they seldom come in the midst of a theosophical lecture, but perhaps you drift off into that timeless moment. But moments of great beauty, in the experience of love, in the silence and solitude, when the mind is brought to a quiet knowing. Music, a walk in the bush, along a beach when we are alone. Sunset, sunrise. In the midst of the constant change inherent of each and each of these events, there seems a sense of the timeless. Not long ago, I came on a very simple and interesting statement by the American psychologist Joan Borisenko. Very simple. She wrote, "Look for balance at the doorway where Chronos, linear clock time, meets Kairos, eternal timelessness." Can we stand for a moment in that doorway? Like the Roman god Janus, for whom this month is named, look in both directions, toward the world of time in which our daily lives are lived. What time is dinner? What time will breakfast be? I suppose right now it's really what time is dinner. and when will she speak, stop speaking, and so on. Standing in that doorway, looking into the room where time is, in which our daily lives are lived, and looking also into that other room, which is a non-room, so to speak, no walls, the realm of the timeless, which may be the domain of the spirit. I think perhaps when we learn to stand in that doorway, we will know that the timeless underlies the time, underlies time itself, makes time possible, reveals time, not simply as linear as clock time, chronos, but as cyclic. Perhaps we learn, too, that a doorway is just that, a way that is single, leading into two worlds. And you know what happens to people who stand in doorways. They get knocked out of the way. And so we have to learn to move, I think, effortlessly between time and the timeless, without anxiety, without regret for leaving this or anticipation for entering into that. The naturalist, Terry Tempest Williams, in an address that was given last year to a conference of the Institute for Noetic Sciences, put it this way as a naturalist. Life, death, rebirth. If I have learned anything from my work as a naturalist, he said, from spending time in the field, it's a belief in the cycle of things, the truth of natural processes, seeing the world whole, even wholly. Change is growth. Growth is life, and life is death. What are we afraid of? But our search often for the timeless continues, a search for what we think of as the changeless. So it is, as I say, that we must ask, what is time? And moving through time or experiencing time as movement, where is the timeless? Is it possible to experience in the midst of change the changeless? In the midst of time, the timeless? J. Krishnamurti, in conversation with the physicist Dr. David Bohm, spoke of the ending of time, not as a condition of timelessness, but as a psychological state of what I would call and interpret as no time, a hyphenated word. Perhaps I can add that as a new word, no time. Krishnamurti went on to suggest that the ending of time is a beginning, but not a beginning that implies time. Ending and beginning, Mr. Krishnamurti pointed out, are no special time. They can be any time or no time at all. It reminded me of a statement that I read many years ago by the Jewish theologian Martin Buber, who commented that the opening words of the Judaic Christian Bible, in the beginning, should really read, should be translated from the Hebrew, for the sake of a beginning. That is, that it is an indication that it's not a time that one calls beginning, but for the sake of undertaking a process, that there is a creative process or movement without time that is constantly recurring. And therefore, we use the term beginning simply to indicate a freshness, a newness that has come about. I think so often we see time as a kind of enemy, simply because psychological time produces conflict. And we say that conflict arises. Perhaps we should put it this way, conflict arises out of a sense of time that is psychological in content. Time creates division, and to end conflict, therefore, there must be an end to division. Again, if I may quote Mr. Krishnamurti, when there is that absolute cleansing of the mind from the accumulation of time, then something arises. Happily, he does not say what that something is, because what is that something? If it is fresh, if it is new, can one define it? Can one put it into words? And I think, I feel that is why he spoke of it as a something that's not simply a realm, in a realm without time, but a something that is here, now, immediate, fresh, new. In this immediacy of now, which has no time at all. The philosopher Gerald Hurd, quoted by Daryl Rainey in his remarkable book, The Death of Forever, a marvelous title, isn't it? The Death of Forever, suggested three attitudes toward time. I think they're not so much attitudes as perhaps stages in the growth of consciousness. For ultimately, if you examine it, time is a matter of consciousness, isn't it? We've spoken of that. I'm not talking about clock time. Yes, don't worry. I'm not going to lose track of clock time and go into some realm of consciousness in which I speak forever. You'll be grateful to know that. But rather, stages in the growth of consciousness in our relation to what we think of as time. There is the time unaware animal. The animal is not concerned with, you know, clock time, except the time there are certain inbuilt and perhaps unconscious, from our point of view unconscious, but conscious in terms of the animal, of coming to eat, to feed, to sleep, and so on. But a kind of unawareness, at least an unaware selfness in it. Then there is the time-haunted human, as Gerald Hurd called it. And I think that's where we mostly are. We're haunted by it. And finally, the time-understanding mind. We stand at the midpoint, as I suggest, time-haunted, whether by biological clock time, how many years have you lived, you know, and you begin to get anxious. I haven't done what I intended to do. My life is going all too swiftly. I haven't achieved anything. What was it we set out to achieve? You know, I haven't done that. I haven't reached my goal. Thank goodness. Happily, there are more incarnations. It's very comforting. Psychological time, we're haunted by it. Historical time, and we're haunted by our history. And those who are not able to learn from their history are, as has been said, doomed to repeat it. The Neoplatonist Plotinus, following on Plato indeed, defined time as the life of the soul in movement as it passes from one stage of experience to another, and added, if then soul withdraws, sinking again into its primal unity, time would disappear. The origin of time, wrote Plotinus, clearly is to be traced to the first stir of soul's tendency toward the production of the sensible universe. Soul begot at once the universe and time. Well, if we substitute the term ego or the ego self complex or the psychological complex, however you want to phrase it, often the term is self-centered ego sense for Plotinus's term soul, then we recognize that it is with the awakening of that sense of self, my self, your self, the sense of an individual selfhood separate from all others, that a sense of time enters into consciousness. You can examine it. The more we feel that sense of selfness, separate from the rest. The more time haunts us, the more time absorbs us. As Dr. Rainey, for example, in the book that I've already mentioned, The Death of Forever, puts it, in gaining self, man stepped out of the dreaming and into time. And of course, as an Australian, he was speaking of the dreaming as that original non-time condition, that timeless condition which is always being present, which is always here, but out of which all the universe arose. And as a scientist, a microbiologist, Dr. Rainey reminds us that from the standpoint of physics, contemporary physics, time has no verifiable status. It is a fictional map we draw on the seamless space-time fabric so that we can find our way around. I think that's a marvelous statement. It's a fictional map we draw on the space-time fabric, which is without any seams, any coming together of seams. Just a fictional map that enables us, as he says, to find our way around. Consequently, he suggests, the mind or consciousness, aware of itself, self-reflective, we may say, which is our current status, we are self-reflective, needed an ordering principle and a nexus of reference. That ordering principle became time. And so we separate events is an ordering principle. And that nexus, reference point, becomes the self. What I feel is important. This must be done now. How often have you said, I have to do this today? And has anyone ever said to you, why do you have to do it today? But because that reference point of the self has determined the order in which things will be done, which is time, we feel it is important. Note this in your own experience. To put it another way, the physicist Dr. John Wheeler has said that time is what keeps everything from happening at once. And so we could add, the sense of self is what keeps everything apart so that we can deal with the world and all that is within it. So it is not so much time that moves, but our own sense of an individual self voyaging by virtue of the choices that self makes among what I call the hills and valleys of a future that is already present. This may sound deterministic, but it is not in actuality. Perhaps there's a mystery in the fact that from one point of view, the future is as much here as the past, both contained in the present. What is unfolded, if I can put it this way, is our consciousness, with all its reactions, its unique imprinting of feelings and thoughts upon the events as they occur or have occurred. The physicist, again, to my point is not to get into the scientific explanations too much, but the physicist Louis de Broglie has put the matter this way. In space-time, which is, as you know, now suggested as the continuum of the universe, everything which for each of us constitutes the past, the present, and the future is given en bloc. Each observer, as his time passes, discovers, so to speak, new slices of space-time which appear to him as successive aspects of the material world, though in reality, the ensemble of events constituting space-time exist prior to his knowledge of time. So what we see is a kind of slice through the fabric of space, of the fabric of the universe, that fabric of space-time. And we say, this is what is here, this is what has been, this is what will be. Time, therefore, is, as I've suggested earlier, far stranger than we think, because the moving finger of time is essentially a figment of our imagination. Because the moving finger of time is essentially a figment of our imagination. We know, for example, that in the laws of physics, there is no inbuilt time asymmetry, as Dr. Rainey puts it, and other scientists have said the same thing. There is no inbuilt time asymmetry. But my concern, really, in talking about time and the timeless is not to engage in a review of current scientific thought and views of time. And I suppose many of us here, many of you, have read that very fascinating work by Stephen Hawking, A Brief History of Time, which became a bestseller. It's amazing. One wonders how many of us really understood it. I didn't fully. Many other commentaries by very reputable scientists probing this mystery of time. But I'd like to really, again, keep stressing the point of our own experience, which is essentially a point of view, the nexus of that individual self that is you, that recognizes the primacy of consciousness. And looked at from such a perspective, I think we cannot fail but acknowledge that among other and equally important and significant insights, it is impossible to change our own attitude and the human attitude towards self and time without causing an equally profound change in the human attitude toward death. One of the areas of recent, great deal of research, scientific and some that's been very dubious, but a great deal of research, has been in what that area known as the near-death experiences. And all of them, virtually without fail, those who have had what are known as the NDEs, the near-death experiences, report a sense of the timeless. Why? A sense of the loss of self. There is no reference point. So we can put it in another way. Every age in history, every culture, every civilization has drawn its coherence, its identity, from the story or the myth which informs its future and underpins its social structure. Our story, for example, in this 20th century, which is rapidly drawing to a close, our story, when the history of this age is written in full by future historians, anthropologists, social scientists, will be the story, the myth of science. But we are awakening in consciousness to an awareness of the philosophical implications of that story. And we are moving inexorably, if I can put it that way, from the reductionist, materialistic view, which still grips many scientific thinkers and many individuals around the world, to a humanistic and holistic point of view. Because it is the philosophy that undergirds us. We're awakening in consciousness. For example, as just pointed out, and again using the language of Dr. Rainey, from the standpoint of physics, there is no observable quantity called time, only space-time. Therefore, to quote Dr. Rainey further, time is the greatest barrier that nature has erected between the average structure of the human mind and reality. What then is reality? What is reality for each of us? Let me quote just one more physicist, the American physicist Fred Alan Wolfe, from his work Parallel Universes, which I would love to explore with you also because it's a fascinating concept. As he put it, the past, present, and future exist side by side. If we were totally able to marry corresponding times each and every moment of our time-bound existence, there would indeed be no sense of time, and we would all realize the timeless state which is taken to be our true or base state of reality by many spiritual practices. That is a physicist. So pure consciousness, consciousness free of its own ego cage, because the ego is like a squirrel in a cage and goes around and around with its own self concerns, would see this timelessness without any sense of past, present, or future, without, in other words, that sense of linear time which drives us all. And in such a state, I think we would awaken to what has been called the central feature of archaic time, its cyclicity, the concept of regenerative renewal, rebirth. To be free of time is to be free of a separative self, is to be free of death. It is to be free, really, of that ego self which ever seeks to sustain its separate existence through time. Paradoxically, of course, to be free of death is to acknowledge death as ever present. To be genuinely free of time is to acknowledge the timeless at every moment. To be free of death is to acknowledge death as present every moment at what has been called the cutting edge of consciousness. For death is itself the midwife of creative change, of transcendence, of regeneration and transformation. Until we learn to die, we will not learn to live. Separateness is always anchored in the sense of an individual personal self, a self which is itself anchored in time. The block in our minds comes from that sense of separateness, which is, as we should know from all the words of the sages and the wise individuals of all ages, an illusion, the source of sorrow, the cause of conflict. In reality, nothing is separate. Everything is united in one vast network of being. Everything is engaged, as it has been said, in the dance of becoming. The essence of the human quest is to be free of time, to reconnect to the eternal, the timeless, the immortal. In that infinite space where the past and future interleave, that space is, if I may call it thus, the reality laboratory of our own minds. It is the original space of consciousness. H.P. Blavatsky, who gave us that wisdom tradition in contemporary terms, gave as one of her final gifts to the world a magnificent diagram of meditation. And in that diagram, which she gave to her students, she recommended meditation on the infinity of space and the wholeness of time. No time. From such a meditation would arise, she said, an awareness of unity, characterized by courage. In that awareness, the separative self is no more. In her magnum opus, The Secret Doctrine, Blavatsky pointed out that time is only an illusion produced by the succession of our states of consciousness as we travel through eternal duration. And it does not exist where no consciousness exists in which the illusion can be produced. Our minds are shadowed by that illusion, and we take the shadow for the reality. This does not mean, by any means, that in the mundane world of our everyday existence, time is irrelevant. Clock time is useful. Linear time is necessary, and in its own sphere, essential to our movements in the world, especially if you're going to be on time at an airport to take a plane. You cannot really say, I live in the timeless, and I expected the plane to be there when I arrived. Time in and of itself does not do anything, but it provides space for all things to happen. And only when we are in time does it appear constrictive. We are caught in time only when we forget that we are nested in the timeless, the eternal. Let me repeat then the words I quoted earlier, written by Joan Borisenko. Look for balance at the doorway where Chronos, linear clock time, meets Kairos, eternal timelessness. Kairos is also the right moment, the moment when, as it were, the timeless intersects the timed. It is the present moment in which all possibilities exist. It is we who close out the choices. All choices are before us. Indeed, the choice is always ours. At the same time, to use the word in another context, every choice has its consequences, and every choice arises then out of past choices. But the reality of choice, the possibility of choice, endures beyond the changes that change, that the choice itself brings about. And that which endures, and that which is ever passing away, by reason of change, is the eternal order, the pattern of existence, a pattern which includes both creation and dissolution, both life and death, both the present, the past, and the future. Time, then, may be called the cosmic dimension in which the endless variety of eternal reality, that is the underlying pattern of existence itself, a pattern which is and exists, actualizes itself in the phases between creation and dissolution. Time is the dimension in which the strangely endowed energy we call life, that energy which is consciousness, develops in experience. Well, it may be wondered through all that I have said why I've chosen to speak on this search for the timeless. The search is not for the timeless. It is for that unitary wholeness which underlies all our existences. These thoughts arose originally, as I said, because we stand in a doorway between that time we call 100 years of the past and a time that we think of as 100 years of the future, a watershed period, this time in which we live. But for each of us, that moment in which we become awake to the fact that it is not we, not any separate self, in which there is only that, then we know the time of supreme choice, a time of incarnation which is itself a choice, the result of all the choices we have made. And we move into that unity. We're all explorers. We're all time travelers. In many ways, you know, we perhaps are like lost children seeking home. We have a dim memory of home, a place where we have been before, in the future. For our task is to remember the future, to forget that we were separate selves. There's some words of the great poet T.S. Eliot who speak to this. Time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, and time future contained in time past. And so he said, or wrote, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. So I'm not only addressing our concern with this cycle of 100 years. Even more important is what the concept of time does to us, how it molds us, shapes us, yes, and even governs us, because we long to preserve the little ego self contained within the cage of its own making, the cage of time, which has no meaning except that which we give it. So let me conclude with some lines that are favorites of mine, my very favorite lines, favorite perhaps because they are so simple. Yesterday is history. Tomorrow is a mystery. Today is a gift. Perhaps that's why we call it the present. Presents are for opening. Let us open the present and find the eternal and the timeless. Thank you.